Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail pro.
Show,
they got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, that be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fucking promise. Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, shit, that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police department to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
In order for us to be in the state that we are in today as people, we have to be out of our minds. We literally have to be crazy. It is necessary for us to be crazy. It is necessary for us to be backwards. It is necessary for us to be maladjusted. It is necessary for us to be disunited. It is necessary for us to be self-hating. It is necessary for us to be filled with an inferiority complex. In a world where the European is essentially about 10% of the world's population, if that 10% is to continue to rule over the other 90%, it must keep that 90% out of its mind. It must keep that 90% in a state of deception. It must keep that 90% filled with a feeling of powerlessness and incompetence. if this 10% is to continue to consume more than 60% of the world's resources, if this 10% is to continue to rob African, Asian, and other nations of their material wealth, then it must keep those people in a state of maladjustment. And this implies then that no matter how much integration you may bring about, the feeling of inferiority must be a constant in the black personality. No matter how many people you run for president, no matter how many mayors you get elected, no matter how many people you get on the board of IBM and the others, the basic sense of inferiority, the basic sense of dependency must remain a constant in the black mind. And I will indicate this, and I think this study, which occurred now some 40 years later, shows this to be the case. Dr. Clark shows surprise that after all of this time, this feeling is still there. I would not, and I don't think any student who's basically looked at the necessity of black people being out of their minds as being the foundation of European dominance would not be surprised. I think it was quite predictable. Remember, these children have this feeling of inferiority basically from the end of their second years. You can pick up this sense of inferiority as early as three and a half years old. So it starts very early. And I'm still working through my mind the implications of that finding. We are talking about preschool children, not only children that are in school, but children who are having this feeling prior to school. This would, of course, indicate that to a degree that our environment is saturated with racism through TV, through the various media, through the pictures I put on the walls, through the unconscious and conscious state that influences the child's behavior and attitude starting in the womb itself. And I often start my developmental classes not with the prenatal period and how egg meets sperm, but with why do you have children in the first place? Because the reasons you have children will influence their development. It will influence them from the time they're in your womb until, of course, the day they die upon this earth. It would indicate then that to a degree and in some way the black community itself has been induced in helping to bring about a feeling of inferiority in its children. To a good extent, it is not so much the actions of racism that destroy us, the discrimination by white folk and Europeans, the kind of hatred that they express toward us as people that destroys us and gives us an inferiority complex. It is to a good degree how we as people react to these actions. Whether we believe the propaganda or not, whether we believe what the European actually has said, we cannot often control the behavior of other people, but we do have a greater control over how we react to that behavior. And to a good extent, the challenge of an Afrocentric education is to educate us in our tendencies to react. To a good extent, it would mean that the actions of racism apparently have induced some of us to accept racist propaganda and to really believe it, to internalize it. Once we internalize the propaganda, then we become social agents for the racists themselves. And to a good extent, then, the black family, once it internalizes the propaganda of Eurocentric racist, becomes a social agent for the racist and begins to produce the kinds of children that the racists want from the time of conception onward. It becomes instructive, you see, to look at a family not as something that just raises children, But a family, to a good extent, is the social agent of the society. It produces the kinds of children that the society says it needs and wants. The family looks out at the opportunity structure, at its own social position. It looks out at what it views as the future for its children, for its group, for its nation, and it inculcates those views into its children and rears its children in terms of those views, sometimes consciously and sometimes unconsciously. And in that way, it begins to create the children for the society. In a heavily segregated society, for instance, if your black boy or girl would have said some years ago that they wanted to be president of the United States or that they were going to be president of the United States, how many of us, by being realistic, would have discouraged that view? You know, ain't no black man going to be this or no black woman going to be that. Be real. And in the service of being real, by saying, well, I don't want him to be disappointed. I want to save him from racism and save him from the recognition one day that there are limitations to his aspirations. We quietly steer them toward a trade or a skill. Get this and get a job. So you, what's happening there? While it may have a realistic basis in a certain sort of way, you are also at the same time, though, creating the child's aspirations. You're also creating the child's motivations. You're creating the child's view of itself in line with the way the society is structured. A true Afrocentric family not only relates to its children in terms of reality, but it relates to its children in terms of idealism. It relates in the sense that there is a world that it as an African family and we as an African people want to bring about. While the black man may not be president of the United States, it does not mean that he cannot rule the world. The true Afrocentric family then not only raises its children in terms of the so-called social realities, because it recognizes that social realities are things that men create themselves. And therefore it raises children to create a reality suitable to the advancement and development of black people. But an unconscious black family, an unconscious people, a people who've fallen victim to racism, a people who've fallen victim to a sense of inferiority, then will produce the kind of inferior children that the white society needs to continue its dominance in the world. And in this way, then, the black family and the black community and black leadership becomes allied with the dominant group and with the Eurocentric group. It is this kind of thing that we must come to become conscious of and to defeat consciously. I'm going to give you a little taste of what I'm writing about in my current book. I want to indicate that black maladjustment is not just a suffering in the soul of black people. It's not just a feeling of inferiority in which over which the individual has to get. It's not just a feeling of alienation that you get over by going to a therapist, that you get over by attending various therapeutic sessions. Black maladjustment is functionally necessary for the world as it is currently constituted. Black maladjustment is a political factor, and I often try to get across to people the understanding that when we go to these universities and these schools, one of the greatest deceptions that's run upon us is the idea that the things that we are taught in these schools are non-political, that they are neutral, that they are somehow universal. And of course, the whites run a beautiful game on us when they, for instance, name their courses without putting their ethnicity in front of them. They don't say white psychology, white education, white economics, white physics, white chemistry, you know. And we often naively then assume because they're called economics, psychology, anthropology, that means we are in a course that has general and universal meanings. And we are made to think that we are odd when we call a course Black Studies, that there's something wrong with it. But every course in the American college and university and in the American educational establishment is a course in white studies, ladies and gentlemen. And every course in every discipline is designed for essentially the same thing, to maintain white dominance. We must be very conscious of that, and we must recognize that a major part of the education of our children and of ourselves is the fact that we have to politicize the courses that we're taking, even science, even physics and chemistry. So a lot of people think, well, you know, we're talking about atoms and molecules and this and that, and they have no ethnicity and they have no politics. In a fundamental way, you may be right, but on another level, there's a problem with that. Science, scientific thinking, and technological development does not just develop in the head of some genius. It's not the result of some scientific genius who happened to strike upon some major discovery. Scientific discovery and technological development take place within a political social structure. You have to have a political system, a system of social relations, an economic system in order that science and technology develop and flourish. They do not flourish in a vacuum. Therefore, it is not enough just to teach your children physics and chemistry. You must teach them the politics of physics and chemistry. You must teach them the economics of physics and chemistry. You must teach them how a system must organize itself politically and socially such that physical and chemical research take place. It is not enough for us to educate African boys and girls in science and technology so that Africa can catch up with the Europeans. You will never catch up with the European just by knowing science and technology. Because, ladies and gentlemen, you have to finance technological research. You have to pay scientists to do research. People just don't do research for nothing. If you run the latest physics experiment, you would have to produce a cyclotron with a circumference of some 20 or 30 miles around that costs billions of dollars. And if you're then talking about catching up with the European scientifically, then you must catch up with the European and surpass him what? Economically. If your children are to work for you and give their scientific genius to the advancement of black people, then we as black people must give them an economic, social, and political foundation in which their gifts can be realized and handed over to us as a people. And therefore, merely to teach chemistry and physics as some neutral subject, as some body of knowledge unrelated to everything else going on into the world, is to be miseducated. That is one of the reasons why we have a country filled as black people with chemists, with engineers, machinists, and yet we don't seem to be able to export one gun to South Africa. We don't seem to be able to make one bomb. We have generals and sergeants and green berets and rangers and all of the rest, and yet we are unable to train one guerrilla or anything else to fight for their liberation in this world because there's a lack of social organization. It is not enough just to have knowledge. It is not enough just to have money. Money and knowledge must be organized in order to be effective. And knowledge, in order to flourish and be actualized in some concrete advancement for people, must be based ultimately on social relations between those people. So there must be a social structure. And while your children are learning science and mathematics, they must learn to love themselves and to love one another, and to cooperate one with the other. Or else they'll have an Afrocentric mind, but they will still have to go down to IBM and Xerox and do their work. And ultimately then, they will still be racked by a sense of inferiority and dependency. So we must keep that in mind. Let me quickly state here then that the sense of inferiority in black people and the other problems we talk about will not be removed by assimilation. They will not be removed by integration. They will not be removed by Jesse Jackson being elected President of the United States. They will not be removed by the election of other black politicians. And that doesn't say that Jesse Jackson shouldn't be elected, and it doesn't say that other politicians should not be elected. I'm saying, though, we cannot look at those things as being the sole basis for removing and solving the kinds of problems that we have. Because maladjustment is not merely a malady of the individual personality. Maladjustment is functional for a system. That system sometimes can be a family. Do you know sometimes a family is held together by a sick person? It is a scapegoat, a quote-unquote black sheep, around which the family defines itself. Sometimes a husband and wife keep a relationship because one of them is sick. And when one goes to the psychiatrist somewhere and try to get better, decide that they're going to change their life, the relationship breaks up. And often families will subtly pull a member back into alcoholism and other kinds of problems as a way of maintaining itself, even though it may be claiming aloud that it's really concerned with getting the person well. Because often the sickness of one individual works to the advantage of another one. And I will say then, when you see a society producing a lot of illness, the illness must be functional for that society. The sick people must be playing a very valuable role in that system. In other words, people don't drive you crazy for nothing. There's some benefit involved. Let me read this section then. The question that often goes unasked or unanswered from a general theoretical point of view is one that's asked, what familial societal role is played by the maladjusted personality? Why are we sick and why do we have the inferiority complex that we have as people? If the maladjusted personality is created and maintained by a social system, whether that system be dyadic, that is a system where there's a relationship between two people, familial or society, then it is reasonable to assume that such a personality, that is the maladjusted personality, is created and maintained because it is needed, because it is essential to the functioning of that system or some segment of that system. The maladjusted personality is created and maintained in service to another. I've often said, of course, one of the problems we have as people is that we are a created people. We are a creation of the Eurocentric Dr. Frankenstein. And we have been created to serve the purpose of Europeans. One of the major goals of an Afrocentric education and of Afrocentric development is that we become self-developed, that we determine what our personality traits will be, that we determine our destiny and our direction, and not be determined by our reactionary relationship to some other people. Often a maladjusted personality is created and maintained in service to parental and familial self-image, to societal, economic, political values and goals. If the maladjusted personality is a defensive and avoidant one, and such defensive and avoidant tendencies are deemed neurotic, then they are created to defend the individual against neurotic demands and to protect it, to help him avoid a reality that is painful. However, that doesn't mean that the individual is not engaged also in serving the society. Often, we look at a neurotic person as a defensive personality, as a personality that is avoidant. It seeks to avoid certain responsibilities and certain reactions and certain realities. We must also see, though, that personality in defending itself, in avoiding certain realities, actually serves another group or another person. I was doing a lecture here on self-hatred. And in the very first lecture, I dealt with the image of the blonde, blue-eyed Jesus. And I made the statement that you had to beware of a church such that when you walk into it, the first thing you see is a blonde, blue-eyed Jesus back behind the altar. That church is lying to you. And that church is going to have send you to hell. How did I say that? Because first of all, there's nowhere in the Bible that a description of that Jesus has ever been given. And secondly, that Bible strictly states that graven images should not be made. And it's done. And one minister jumped up, offended because of that statement, and took the statement personally. And I'm a minister in the such and such a church, and I took a course under Dr. Cone at Columbia University, and you know, just laid it all out for me, you know, and objected to it as if I were attacking the minister directly when I was dealing with the concept and I was dealing with the psychology of having gods painted in alien forms and how that induces self-hatred and maintains self-hatred in the people. How praying to a white man is damaging to black people. And how thinking of God as a white man is damaging to black people. I'm dealing with the concept here. Yet she felt a need to defend what she thought of as herself and her profession. But in defending herself, she actually defended the system. She actually defended the status quo. And many of us then, as neurotics, you see, as we engage in our neurotic and maladjusted behavior and defend our egos and defend our vanities and defend our pride, actually support and hold up the system. It's embarrassing or justify the abusing family. And how we, in many instances, end up justifying the system that abuses us. Integration itself indicates that, wanting to live and be loved and lay around with people who destroyed us and enslaved us and given us the greatest pain in the world. So that's what we call in psychology the love of the aggressor. To the people you want to love most are the people who've done the most damage to you. Unhealthy personalities cannot be created by healthy environments. Since the unhealthy of an individual or group can result in the relative health, wealth, security, and power and sense of identity of another individual or group, then it serves the interest of the latter group. In other words, the unhealth of the black community serves the health and wealth of the white community. Just as the sickness of the drug addict serves the health and wealth of the pusher. So in a sense then, it becomes in the interest of the pusher to keep the addict, of course, addicted, even though he claims he's doing him a service and a favor. The latter group becomes dependent, that is the unhealthy group, comes to need the unhealthiness, and that is the dominant group really becomes dependent and comes to need the unhealthiness of the former. If the health of the former means a reduction in the dominance of the latter, then the latter resists the health of the former despite its pretensions to the contrary. In other words, when we even see assimilationism, we don't have time to talk about it here tonight, but in many ways assimilationism and integrationism is really another prompt for the maintenance of white power. And while we thought that we bought it in to a great extent, I would argue that to a good extent the white ruling class helped to push it as well because it also helps to maintain the white ruling class in power. When you have a minority of people, such as the European, often in order to stay in power they must recruit from the very people they oppress. And therefore they will call up from those people certain talented people or other types who then will identify with their masters and help them to maintain the control over the masses. This often will be called integration and will often be called desegregation. But ultimately, if you look very closely, you'll notice one thing, that the real power relationship between those two groups has not changed. I talk about a number of things we call constants. That if we look closely in the relationship, at the relationship between Europeans and Africans, we will note that there are certain basic things that have not changed despite all of the other things we look at. Despite integrationism, despite political and social change, there are things that are still basically the same and have been the same for the last 400 years. The real power of black people, particularly if you talk about military power, has not changed fundamentally since the very time we met the European. You may find African countries now with jet planes and tanks that they bought from Europeans, by the way, and still have yet to make. And you may think then that the Africans have entered into a modern era in warfare and so forth, but I would dare say that there's not a single African country that could really protect the interests of black people against European power, particularly as that power moves out into space and can rain down on the African continent bombs and laser weapons and other weapons of various types. And African countries having no anti-ballistic system, no Star Wars system, no system to fight war in space is literally defenseless. And yet they may fly the latest American jets, and in the face of American and European war power, we are still ultimately defenseless. That has not changed fundamentally in 400 years, ladies and gentlemen. The European economic control of this globe fundamentally has not changed either. The European control of information has not changed fundamentally either. The European control of definition, the definition of reality, the definition of what is and is not, has not changed fundamentally either. That has been the case for a long time. The European tendency to degrade things African has not changed as well. You may now have a degree in computer technology. You may now have a job that pays you $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year, but your fundamental relationship to the European has not changed one whit from the fundamental relationship between our African forefathers and his European slave master. For as you work your computers, you still work to the profits of Europeans. And so the fact that we've moved into the executive offices, does that mean we've moved into power? Does not mean that the fundamental power relationship between Europeans and Africans have changed one bit. As a matter of fact, the moving of blacks into the executive offices is an effort to maintain that power and to obscure that power behind a form of neocolonialism. I don't think it is an accident that the desegregation movement and the assimilationist movement in America parallel the neocolonial movement in Africa. As I often tell my classes, you as black students are now being educated to put a black face on white power and to help deceive your people into thinking because you got a job, we have moved forward as a people. Let's then just take a quick look at the functions of maladjustment and why you cannot get blacks, why it is important that blacks never get out of their sickness. You ever wondered why the more social workers you produce, the crazier people get? The more psychologists you produce, the crazier people get. Have you ever wondered about that? I lost a job challenging whites about that. Why you, as a white man, whom these crazy people have permitted to be chairman of the Department of Predominantly Hispanic and Black College, why do you, as a black man, a white man, continue to try to bring these psychologists in here when you know that this psychology is not doing the black and Hispanic community one whit of good? He could not disagree with that. How do you pretend to judge the qualifications of black people for teaching other black people and Hispanic teachers and Hispanic students, when you admit every day in the New York educational system that you don't know how to educate black children? We have a group of people who lament about their inability to educate black children, how black children are so-called uncontrollable and ineducable and all of that, and yet they want to sit on a board and determine who is qualified and not qualified. We have this insult downtown where these white dogs are going to try to determine who should be the chancellor of New York City schools, and yet have admitted that they cannot educate black children. And we'll sit there and let them try to lay the foundation and tell us what the credentials of an educator is supposed to be. How do you qualify to tell us what the credentials of an educator is supposed to do? You have not demonstrated that you are capable of educating black people. But yet there are a lot of us who want to sit back and talk about standards and degrees and all this other nonsense that the people who've clearly admitted that they failed have laid upon us. And yet we have a lot of this going on in the system. But this kind of stuff must happen if black people are to continue to be subordinated. How is it functional? The captive African maladjustment justifies European dominance and exploitation. Because we are crazy, because we are criminals, because we are addicts, because we are that, the Europeans have a right to put their police in our community. They have a right to run the welfare agencies that keep us crazy, by the way. They have a right to intrude into our cultural families and personal lives. Why? Because, you see, they are maladjusted. They have learning deficiencies. They have this and that. Therefore, we're coming in to help and treat them in some sort of way. We are bringing in foreign aid. We are calling on the IMF to study and regulate their national economies and so forth. So you will see the so-called sickness and dependency and lagging in development and all of these other kinds of things every day are justifications for the Europeans to intrude upon African life and seek to control that life. And when we accept their definitions, we accept their dominance. We ask for their dominance, and we see their dominance as some kind of aid to us. Yet when we look some 40 years later, we are in the same position or in a worse position than before. How do we solve it? Asking more of it. Well, let's get more degrees. Let's see that the teachers get more degrees. Even though the more degrees they get, the worse the education has become. But what's the solution? Send them back to school for some more. The more money that's been pumped into school, what happens? The worse the education has got. What's the solution? Let's put more money into school. Idiotic solutions all over the place. But you see, you cannot expect a neurotic to think normally. That's the essence of being what? Neurotic. If you thought normally, behaved normally, you wouldn't be a neurotic, would you? So being maladjusted justifies European dominance, rationalizes Eurocentric treatment, as I just said, of African people, and thereby reduces their guilt and self-condemnatory feelings for behaving toward the African in ways contrary to their stated political and constitutional, ethical, moral, religious principles. You know, these great Christians and these great people who believe in equality. How do you believe in equality? You know, the greatest problem in this country was, how do you believe in the equality of man and yet enslave a group of men? How do you believe in this and mistreat and discriminate? In order to get out of that dilemma, then, you must make those people what? Less than men. Less than human. You see? So then in that way you can justify what you do. They're not fully human. They're not fully men. They're not fully intelligent. They're not fully capable of self-government. They're not fully capable of guiding themselves. Therefore, it's only incumbent on us, those of us who are lucky enough to be more intelligent and divinely sent to rule over men, to take care of them. It is incumbent upon us to take up what? The white man's burden, which happens to be the black man. But actually, the other way around is we have to carry them as a burden. The maladjustment of black people maintains Eurocentric self-esteem, self-definition and identity, self-concept, sense of security, and control. Since the captive African's debilitated state, debased and degraded nature will not permit him to successfully overcome such dominance. The lowest European on the lowest street, Skid Row in this country, can always say one thing, at least I'm not black. He defines himself, and his self-esteem still rests upon the ultimate degradation of black people. So no matter how low and evil he sinks, he still has a superiority attitude toward black people. And therefore, the degradation of black people and maintaining black people in that state is important to the European sense of self-esteem and self-identity. The European more or less defines himself in contrast to the African person. Many of you have run into Europeans, and when you came to be what they did not expect to be, you've seen them unravel before your very eyes. When they could not play their accustomed role of dominance and mastery, you've seen them become unglued and unable to function, to become confused. It means then that our submission and subordination and degradation keeps them together. And therefore, it is necessary for them to maintain this degraded state in black people in order to maintain their sense of self as a people. And by maintaining us in this debased state and degraded state, they therefore maintain their security, because as long as we think neurotically and maladjustedly, then we will not be able to think in a way that will ultimately defeat them as a people and ultimately destroy them as a people. And remember, we're talking about people who are a minority in the world, and yet who must protect their interests. Black maladjustment induces the captive African to engage in self-defeating behavior, which relieves the Eurocentric establishment of having to impose direct militaristic oppression and to blame the victim for his own predicament. You would get plenty of that, of course. In other words, when you get the black maladjusted to a certain degree, he will treat himself. Well, look, I put libraries in your community. You just don't like to read. We have schools here. You just like to drop out for some reason. The knowledge is available to you. You just don't like it for some reason or other. It's a very slick system, because it permits then the European to pretend that they are liberal and open and so forth, and yet at the same time maintain themselves. And of course, I often talk about this. The European talks about freedom of speech. But we are only free to speak when our audience does not hear us. We are only free to speak when our audience is not interested. We are only free to speak when the audience really does not listen. Oh, I can sit here and call Reagan all kind of name and talk about white folk. That illustrates what a great system we have here. But how is this possible? To a good extent, it's possible because, you see, at first you induce the audience not to be what? Interested. Not to care or to be apathetic, and then you just let the person speak as long as they want to. You induce the audience not to be active, and therefore knowing that after the speech is over, no real activity will take place, so you let them talk as much as they want to. So the system of slavery, you see, and Jim Crowism that occurred shortly thereafter structured the black personality in such a way that despite the Marcus Garveys and the Malcolm X's and other people, there's been relatively little change, because the reception often of the audiences was such that they would not threaten the United States after they heard the speech. We are only free in this country to do the wrong thing. Recognize what happened to Farrakhan. Farrakhan has been saying the same thing for 20 years. But to a good extent, when the whites actually thought that black people might really be listening to Farrakhan, might really act upon what Farrakhan was saying, he can't now get into Javits Center. Now he's having a hard time finding a place to speak and a platform to speak to black people. Is this the country of free speech, ladies and gentlemen? You better not believe it. No way. We say we are free. What is freedom, we say? Freedom to do what we want to do. But stop a minute and think. what makes you want to do what you want to do. And you might come to realize then that our very wants and our very desires have been what? Induced. So that the things we really want and the things we really desire are those things that maintain the system and are those things that destroy us as a people. But yet we object to anyone speaking about it because we see our indulging in them as some expression of our what? Freedom. Yet in this system, when you so-called let a people free, and yet you must maintain them in subordination, they must then, with their freedom of choice, always choose what? The wrong thing. But you give them a foolish pride into thinking that since they have choice, they are therefore free. It's a very slick system. It induces the captive African to behave in such a way such that he will economically and otherwise and apparently of his own accord support the European establishment to the detriment of his own without being conscious of his doing so. Why should a black person be made to feel ugly? What is the function of associating blackness and ugliness? Blackness and uncleanliness? Blackness and unlovable. Is it just purely a racist attitude of some evil people? What do you do when you feel ugly or unkempt? But you do something else beside that. You go out and you buy yourself a new and spend a lot of money. But what's happening here? Who do you spend it with? Who gets the buck of the money that's spent? In other words, the African feeling ugly and unclean in his attempt to compensate for that feeling of ugliness and uncleanliness goes to the very person who made him feel that way in the beginning and purchases and buys from that person. And therefore maintains the very individual that destroyed his self-image to start with. Do you think then an economic system that depends upon a bunch of people trying to compensate for feelings of inferiority by buying brand names, I don't know where brands, you know, by buying names of other people on their clothing, do you think that system is ever really going to let you out of that feeling of ugliness? It can't. It's economically dependent upon that feeling, ladies and gentlemen. If we were made to feel naturally beautiful, don't you know we would destroy the cosmetics and industry? So we must feel naturally that nature itself has not made us beautiful so that we must compensate for it. And therefore we can see then that the inducement of inferiority in black people, the inducement of a feeling of ugliness, the inducement of these various negative feelings must stay in black people so that in trying to compensate for these feelings, black people will economically, politically, and otherwise support the very people that induce them. You see, the alienation of black people is economically functional. It's just not a feeling you have in your mind. The fact that you may wrestle with your own self-estrangement, separation from yourself, is not just a feeling you're having within yourself. It is a politically functional feeling. It is induced for political purposes. What does it mean to be alienated? To be alienated does not only mean that one suffers a split within the personality, that one feels estranged from himself, that one does not know himself. Certainly that's an aspect of alienation, and this is the way it's talked about in the psychology books, you see. And when you read all of this psychology, you think you're really getting heavy, you see, and the Eurocentrics teach it to you very directly, and you feel very profound. When you talk about the great dynamics of the head and ego struggling with one another. Why do you alienate a person? We are alienated so that we can serve aliens. That is the function of alienation. Alienation means to be determined by forces outside oneself, other than oneself, to the enhancement of those aliens. When Marx talks about alienation, then, do not just cue in on the alienation that the worker feels. Recognize that the worker has to be alienated in order to serve the owner of the means of production. That's its ultimate function. You will recognize then, an alienated people can only spend money with aliens. They can only support aliens. They can sit here and support these Koreans and these Arabs and these Indians and everybody else but a black person. They can support everybody's families but their own. They can give jobs to these people's uncles and aunts and sisters and brothers and children, but they cannot give jobs to their own children. They can feel good when they give all of their money to Bloomingdale's and these other places, but they feel cheated every time they trade with a black person. You have to be alienated for that reason. That's why we alienate. And do you think the white man intends to turn that feeling of alienation loose in your heart? You are dead wrong. No matter how often you go into a boardroom, no matter how high you move up into the white hierarchy, because alienation is functional for white power and functional for white economic, social, and political dominance. And yet I see somebody expressing surprise after 40 years that black children still have a sense of inferiority. Because you don't know your black psychology, and because you studied them from a Eurocentric psychological point of view, and because you saw your goal as not removing the white man from power, but of sleeping with him in his beds, and not questioning the evilness of his system, but of wanting to share in it. We never had a national debate. Who gave the NAACP the permission to go out to court and talk for black people in terms of equality? Equality with whom? We should have debated that. That's a moral issue. Equality with the slave master? Equality with exploiters? Equality with people who, every time they stepped on a continent, destroyed and degraded the people that they dealt with? Is this what we want, a sharing of the spoils, or is it that we want a whole different world than what these people have bought on this earth today? But we were diverted from asking that fundamental question. We were made to think simply because we were getting paid.
Thank you. 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 Thank you very much for your warm welcome. It's great to be back here with you again this evening. It's been a while, and I always appreciate coming and being with you, and of course appreciate your support. And I know each time I've been here, I've promised you about our next publication, but it's definitely on the way.
All right.
We are definitely now expecting to be out in November. And of course, each time I talk with you, the book gets larger. At last count, Brother Sababu, my co-partner there, told me we were around about 800 pages. So we're going to try to split it up for you, maybe four and four. Gives you some good wintertime reading. But then in a way, it's when we recognize that we are as complicated as any other people. And one of the things sometimes we underestimate the degree to which we must address ourselves as a people. And too often we have people who think that our issues and the things that we have to deal with can be described in 25 words or less. And that, and so there are people who think that we are small P
people and small-minded people, so they don't have to write sometimes some sizable material. If other nations and other people require libraries to deal with their issues, so do we. And the interesting thing about the upcoming book is that with that 800 pages, it's basically a survey.
All right.
Looking at various areas of life. If you recall, we titled it Blueprint for Black Power. And we are essentially then trying to lay out a blueprint, a prescriptive book. Now we are coming into more and more into prescriptive type of writing, laying out very practical kinds of steps and very practical methods for achieving what it is we must achieve as African people. This means we have to cover a lot of territory. We are covering psychology, we are covering, of course, history, sociology, a great deal of political science, a great deal of economics and related fields, anthropology and so forth, because all of these have to be combined in the process of nation building. And this is what we really have to be about, is the process of building a nation.
All right.
As a people.
All right.
If you're not thinking in terms of nationhood, then I must say, frankly, you're not thinking seriously of being liberated.
All right. All right.
Trying to integrate and merge with our enemies is not going to solve our problem. And it's not going to happen, as a matter of fact. It is a fantasy that has kept us from taking care of business for far too long, the idea that we are going to one day be one with these people. That we are going to merge into invisibility with these white folks. And even if that were possible, we should question our motives for wanting to do so. No. Why would you want to merge with the world's greatest criminals and thieves? With the people who have the worst values the world has ever known? It amazes me sometimes how we can hear some of our parents telling our children we want to be just like them. Yeah. It's a joke. It's an insult to hear Dan Quayle or to hear President Clinton come and lecture black folk on values. How dare we let these people into our churches to try to lecture us on values? Mm-hmm. It's an amazing situation to try to talk to us about values, to try to talk to us about population control. Another joke. Yeah. Yeah. The first thing we think about when people talk about population control is the overproduction of African people. You know, so-called third world people. As I said, we can solve the overpopulation problem quickly if we could reduce the European population drastically. Mm-hmm. Yes, and people, of course, as I tell you, this world has to always be backwards, you see. The ones who need to be reduced most drastically have the world thinking the other way around. Because a good deal of the problem sometimes is not the number of people in the world, but the number of greedy people in the world. Where you have a so-called minority of people who consume the vast majority of the world's resources. This large population that they talk about could eat better if these people weren't eating everything up. And so to a good extent sometimes, to have more for everybody to eat, you have to get rid of the greedy ones. Ones who are over-consuming. Who are taking the food out of other people's mouths. You see? But here you have the people who rob you and take everything you got and then say, you don't have enough to support yourself. You know? And this is the kind of joke that we got going at here. And we're going to come back to this issue of values. But we're going to talk a little bit about African-centered consciousness, personality, and culture as instruments of power. Because ultimately, this is what this whole struggle is about. Power. Not loving one another and all those things we hear. Power. And to a great extent, the problems that we are confronted with today as African people and African people in America flows from our powerlessness or our inappropriate use of power. Right. We've been made to even talk about it. We've been made to think that power is sinful and that to pursue it is a sinful pursuit.
All right. That's right.
And that it's wrong. But you cannot exist without power. Without power, there is no life. A battery without power is dead. You need power to act, to behave in the world, to deal with the world. And consequently then, we must interpret what we are about in terms of power. And we have the power, ladies and gentlemen. We have the possibilities. We just need to reorganize ourselves, reorganize our consciousness and our personality and our culture, and see them as instruments of power and use them as instruments of power to transform our situation. So we should not look at consciousness as some abstraction. As I often tell people, the most practical thing you can have is a good theory, is a good concept to guide your behavior, to be used as an instrument to measure reality, as an instrument to test reality. A good theory then organizes the world and organizes one's approach to the world. It permits one to be able to evaluate the world in terms of where one wants to go and in terms of what one wants to do. To be without theory then is to approach the world on an ad hoc basis, you know, just to meet it here and there and to not approach it in a systematic form. To live reactionarily, always reacting to what other people are doing, always being overwhelmed by events and overwhelmed by the future, instead of creating events and creating the future and making the future.
All right.
See, when one has then a good theory and a good concept, one is able to do that. Consciousness, without human consciousness, there is no world. It is the presence of human consciousness that brings meaning into the world.
All right.
Without human beings in this world, conscious human beings in this world, in effect, there would not be a world. Mm-hmm. We bring the world into being through our consciousness. And through our consciousness, we create the world we live in. Out of the totality of reality, our consciousness cuts out a world that befits itself. In other words, the kind of world you exist in reflects the kind of consciousness that you have. And notice if you change your consciousness or change your values and orientation, you enter into a different world. You interact with different people. People often that you didn't even know existed in the world. Social situations that you might not have even recognized until you entered into a new level of consciousness. You see people, say, for instance, who become addicted, say, to crack or something, and now enter into a whole world and enter into a whole social system that before they became addicted, they hardly noticed. They didn't know what it was all about. And they picked up new friends and new relations, whole new ways of acting, whole new purposes in life they lost old friends, broke with old families, and all kinds of things. In other words, the consciousness, that addictive consciousness, brought into the world a new foreground and put other things into the background. Therefore, man's consciousness is a creative act. And the kind of consciousness you have will determine the kind of world you create.
All right.
And consequently, when you look at the world that we live in, African people, we must recognize to a great extent it is a world of our own creation.
All right.
It is a world that has been generated by the type of consciousness we've been permitted to be instilled in us as a people. As I told you earlier today on the radio, we talk about the white man as having power. And I want you to recognize that power ultimately has to do with a relationship between people. And that the white man's so-called power is to a great extent based upon the nature of the relationship he has with the black man. We empower him by the nature of our own behavior and attitudes as a people. He cannot be, as I said earlier, what he is unless we are what we are.
All right.
I'm telling you. To a good extent, the European is our creation.
All right.
Yes. If we look at our behavior, we will see that to a good extent it is our behavior, our values, our consciousness, the kind of personalities we've established in ourselves, our tastes, our desires and needs that maintains the European in this position.
All right.
We talk about the civil rights movement and the apartheid system of the South. When blacks decided just to get out of the buses and walk, the system changed.
Right.
Yeah. When they just stopped sitting behind the white driver, just changing that relationship.
All right.
Changed the nature of power.
Right.
In that system. When they decided then to walk side by side, when they decided to walk abreast and line themselves up, because they had not walked that way before, for the ends before, the relationship changed. When they kept their monies in their pockets,
right.
When they sat on those stools and blocked the other people from them,
right.
And changed the nature of the interactions between themselves and Europeans, the nature of the system changed. So therefore, we have tremendous power. It depends upon how we align ourselves as a people and how we decide to relate to other people in the world, because they cannot have what they have unless we are who we are.
All right.
And that is why we don't have to spend a great deal of time always appealing to them and analyzing them, because we can better appeal to our own sense of self and our own consciousness. And we waste a lot of time trying to transform them, when through transforming ourselves, they will be transformed automatically. The power is in our hands. We are not destined to be the servants of white folk. That is not the destiny of black folk. No way. And we have to change this idea, because many of us are still operating on that concept. As I said this morning, many of us go to these schools to become what? Qualified. To work for whom? For them. Why do we assume that they're going to have the jobs for us? Yes. These people are having difficulty making jobs for themselves. The greatest problems that the Europeans are facing today and the European economies are facing today is that they are not generating enough jobs for their own people. And even though America is bragging about the millions of jobs it's creating, Those jobs are part-time jobs. The bulk of them are part-time jobs, low-wage jobs, and jobs that have little or no future. So when people talk about creating jobs, you got to ask what kind of jobs are being created. That is why, of course, the system is not investing in black education. It no longer needs black people to maintain its employment structure. You see it bringing in people from outside of the nation to be employed. You see it even is hiring in the world itself, in other nations and other places. Already, it has reached the point where its need for black males is pretty much saturated. And it literally then is warehousing us in the jails and prisons and provoking us to kill each other and to destroy each other out here in these streets. And yet, we are still organizing the education of our children as if the white man still has jobs waiting for them in multitudes. How different our education would be if we sent our children to school to create jobs for themselves. To create their own economic and political systems. To see themselves as the major sources of their employment. As I remarked earlier today while we were in the radio station, I heard something about some people out here protesting for jobs and pushing these other people for jobs. And I asked the question, do we know how many jobs we really create for other people?
All right.
We are a job creating people. We don't realize it because we don't think in terms of nation. You see, if we saw ourselves as a nation, we could see that we create jobs like any other nation.
All right.
I mentioned that today. How many jobs are created by black music?
All right.
Yeah. Look at the whole structure of the music industry. From promoters to manufacturers of the records and the tapes and what have you, to the whole entertainment field, to the sellers of music in the stores, you know what we say, the Tower Records and the other great sellers of records and music and so forth, advertising that uses our music and all these things. How many thousands of jobs are we creating as people? We're creating them, but they have them. You see? We sing the music, they sell it. We sing the music, they market it. We sing the music, they promote it, you see. We sing the music, they produce great conglomerates like Sony, CBS Music, creating all kinds of jobs. We're creating tremendous jobs for a lot of people. How many jobs do we create just buying from Koreans? Buying from other ethnic groups out here? How many people are we creating employment for in terms of our spending habits as a people and our consumption habits as a people? How many jobs are we creating going to jail? We're creating all kinds of jobs and wealth. And we must come to understand this. We are creating these jobs, and yet we are begging for jobs. This means then somewhere our consciousness has been impaired. We're begging for what we are making already. We cannot use our own creations as a source of our own wealth. I told you earlier today that the Creator could not have intended for us as African people to be a poor people if the Creator implanted in our soils all the wealth that was planted there. We talk about the minerals and the oil and the gold and the this and the that that's implanted in African soil. So it seems as if the Creator blessed us from the very beginning with wealth and possibility. Therefore, for us to be going hungry over this wealth and to be starving in the midst of it and to be perceived as a dependent, indebted people while our wealth is being shipped out to other people. We're actually selling a lot of it for pennies and nickels and dimes and less. Means that there is something wrong with our consciousness. Because ultimately, ladies and gentlemen, we've said what? That the wealth of a people is ultimately not in their land. But where is it? In the mind.
All right.
The wealth of man is in his mind. In his consciousness. You got to look at it. And we mentioned the example of Japan. No mineral wealth to speak of whatsoever. Nothing at all. A nation, by the way, which is totally dependent. Of course, we get things backwards, don't we? We see ourselves as depending on Europeans when the reality is the other way around. When they depend on us and our swords and our people, we have to be backwards in order for this situation to be the way it is. Our reality has to be turned backwards, and we have to live in an almost permanent state of deception in order to be used the way we are used. The Japanese must depend on others for their vital resources, their oil, their timber, all of these things that they use to create their technology and so forth is taken from the soils of other people and then sold back to them. And yet they are seen as rich and powerful. And the people whose wealth they take or buy are seen as poor and poverty-stricken. Ultimately, then, you cannot rob or take from wealth from a what? Poor people. You cannot get wealth from a poverty-stricken people. People who have nothing, you can get nothing from. So if you're getting all your diamonds and your gold and your magnesium and all this other stuff, then from African people, then African people must be what? Wealthy and rich. And therefore, if African people are poverty-stricken with this material wealth, then it must be because our consciousness as a people is impoverished. And we are suffering then an impoverishment of our mentality. As we said before, if you have a good mind, you can con another joker out of his land. You can con him out of his diamond and his gold. And this is what the other people have done. They have used their mind and their cleverness and taken from us what they did not have originally. And therefore, consciousness is not an abstract concept. It is not a theoretical concept. It is a concept that is directly related to the reality one lives in and to the reality that one experiences. It is directly related to the type of life that one will live and does live. So I'm going to look at this for a minute. Particularly the consciousness of Africans in America. I'm often somewhat amused and taken aback by the number of people in this society who claim that slavery occurred somewhere back there. That, and you got some so-called black conservatives who claim that slavery no longer influences the nature of African people. I wonder what those people have to conserve in the first place. Are they conserving power? Are they conserving wealth? What does a black conservative conserve? You know, you have to conserve something. And since they have very little, if anything, they must only be conserving the system that has created their poverty to begin with. And you see them ultimately justifying the poverty of African people and justifying the political and social and economic subordination of African people in the name of some kind of higher principles. So slavery is not supposed, the experience of slavery is not supposed to be operating in the mentality of black folk. And you hear a lot of our youngsters will say that as well. How do you talk about slavery? That was back there. Or you know, whites talk about it. Well, you know, that was back there. We don't have anything to do with that anymore. You see? And it's an amazing situation because you have to remind them that you're still living off the interest of the wealth that your forefathers earned from slavery. You are still enjoying the accumulated wealth that began with the enslavement of our people. And if you're going to enjoy the wealth that was generated by evil, then you must take the curse that comes along with it. And therefore, even though you personally had nothing to do with it, but because you have received stolen goods, you must pay the price as well. And because you fight and struggle to protect those stolen goods, and you defend them, and you organize your society and your relationship to white people to maintain them and to continue to enhance them, then you must pay the price. That's why you live in terror. That's why you're stabbed in these streets. That's why you're going to suffer, no matter how good you are. No matter how liberal you are. Mm-mm. Ladies and gentlemen, when we behave as adults, we must recognize that our behavior will be visited upon our children. And that our children pay for our misbehavior. As we say, an act does not end at the point of its occurrence. It continues to reverberate into the future and down across the generations. And that's why when you behave in a particular way, you have to think in terms of seven generations from your behavior as to how what you're going to do is going to affect those generations later on. And even though those children may appear to be so-called innocent, they will still pay the price of your own misbehavior. This country whose parents and whose adults have misspent its treasure, and while they have enjoyed that treasure, ultimately their children will have to pay the taxes and will have to pay the price. So we have a bunch of people out here who think they can rape and rob the world and think that they could have enslaved the world and think then that they are going to sleep well at night. It doesn't work that way. So we have some of our people here who think then that slavery was back then and had nothing to do, and had nothing to do with them. Ladies and gentlemen, we've never escaped slavery. We still share the slave consciousness of our great-great-grandparents. We are of the same mind to a great extent that they were. We have not advanced beyond these people. How can I say that? I generally ask a series of questions. You say that that slavery has nothing to do with you and slavery was back there. And I ask you the question then, what language do you speak? Mm-hmm. When did you learn that language? Was that the language African people were speaking when we were taken into slavery in America? In other words, the language we speak at this moment is what? A slave language. The language that our slave ancestors were forced to learn. And we still speak it, and you can still hear the pidgin, the Creole, and the other kinds of stuff in our language right at this moment that they had to go through. That language, with its words defined by history and by an experience, is the language we use today to guide our behavior. It's the language we use today to talk to ourselves. It's the language we use today to learn about ourselves and to learn about the world. It's the language today we use to try to understand ourselves. Is there no wonder then that we are still confused? So we have not escaped slavery because we are still using a slave language, and we speak the language of slaves. What kind of food do you eat? You say soul food? Was that the food of African people? Slave food. The food that we find most satisfying, the food that we find that sticks to our ribs, the food that we call down home, a food that we learn to eat in the quarters. And yet we dare say that we have escaped slavery, that we have nothing to do with those people back there, that was back there. When our whole very social life and social relationships, our very definition of ourselves as a people, our very attempt to commune with ourselves is mediated by the food of slaves. Understand what I'm trying to get at? And how can you say that you exist in a different consciousness from another people? What kind of uniforms are we wearing? Huh? What kind of clothes are we wearing? Were these the clothes of African people? Huh? This is what we got to look at. Yes. What is this to say then that we've escaped slavery? What kind of names do we respond to? Yes. Yes. Tamikas and all these other things we got going out here. What kind of names do we identify with? Why is it that African names sound strange to us now as a people, and yet we dare say that we have a different consciousness from our great slave grandparents? How can we say that? We are still of the same consciousness. And we are still in the same position because we are still servants of the white man. And our reason for being in America is to serve white folk and to generate wealth for them. And there has been no change at all in terms of our relationship to these people. The values that we pursue are slave values and the values of servants. The social relations that we create and interact with were built and developed during the periods of slavery. We have not escaped it at all. But it is time for us to change the slave consciousness, this consciousness of servitude that is still too much with us today. And ultimately, we ask the question that's closest to home for a lot of people. When we claim that we've escaped slavery and that slavery was something back there which had nothing to do with us today, and then I ask you the question, what kind of God do you worship? What's the name of it? Who taught you to praise him? Was this the God you were praying to before you were brought to these shores? Was this the religion you had before you were brought to these shores? Can you name one African God? How can you then, who define yourself, the very essence of yourself and the very essence of your soul,
and organize the very nature of your life here on earth based on a God handed to us by a slave master, claim that you have no slave consciousness and are not related to slavery.
All right.
In other words, then, ladies and gentlemen, we are not Africans.
All right.
We are possessed by spirits and demons. We have let another people's spirits take possession of our bodies and take possession of our minds. When we speak, it is not with our African voice. It is with the voice of that demonic presence that uses our lips to speak its own language. Yes. Yes, and we have to recognize this. We are possessed. And if we are to transform ourselves and to transform that the nature of our relationship with those who are our masters, we must engage in an exorcism and clear the devils out of our minds. And at this time, then, it'll pay you to read a little bit about demonic possession. And you have to be demonically, we have to be demonically possessed. Because if we talk about black-on-black violence, self-defeating behavior, self-destructive behavior, then we could not be possessed by a beautiful and wonderful God. We must be possessed by a demon. It's interesting to look at the literature on possession. We have a couple of types of possession. One is called a somnambulistic possession. Somnambulistic. Soma, in this instance, having to do with sleep. You hear it in the word somnex. You know. Ambulistic, to move around. Ambulatory. Right? So we're talking about people who are what? Sleepwalking. They're not awake, but they're walking around. The body is moving, and it is walking in an organized fashion and walking systematically, but the person is still asleep. And in somnambulistic possession, then, the individual's original self has been repressed and displaced, and the spirit, and he identifies with the spirit that possesses him. And his eye and the spirit's eye are one and the same. We have a lot of that here today. Where the spirit that has been implanted in us, we have taken to be us. And we've identified with it. That is why in defending ourselves, we end up defending the people who rule over us. In defending our ego, we end up maintaining the social structure that has destroyed our ego to begin with. And you see it in our youngsters who will fight and kill in the name of respect and fight because their egotistic orientation has been insulted. And therefore, in defending their ego, they do not kill the people who destroyed their ego. They kill each other and maintain the ones who destroyed them in the first place in power. And that's why the subtitle of my book, Black on Black Violence, was Black Self-Annihilation in Service of White Domination. We are killing each other in order to maintain this system. We have let ourselves become possessed by a spirit such that when we become aggressive, we aggress against the self instead of those who are the source of our aggressive orientation. We talk a lot as a people about self-hatred. Self-hatred is a personality configuration. It is a form of personality organization. It is an orientation toward the world and toward oneself. Self-hatred, then, is the white man's greatest protection against being destroyed by the black man. To a good extent, self-hatred is the white man's defense mechanism, is the white man's form of self-defense. How can we say that? To a great extent, one function of the personality is to direct energy, to direct aggression, to channel aggression and energy and wishes and impulses in particular directions, to organize feelings, to organize energy to achieve certain ends. Those things that we hate, often then when we are angry or hostile, we aggress against them, don't we? We attack them often. We destroy them. Then we have a problem, don't we? If we attack the things we hate, if we attack the things toward which we hold hostility, when we are overly frustrated and when we are angry, then what happens if that thing we hate is ourselves? It means then, ladies and gentlemen, that differ in handwriting, artistic talent, or even in knowledge of foreign languages. Speak a different language, depending on the personality that's in there. Multiple personalities typically developed in people who were severely and repeatedly abused as children, apparently as a means to protect themselves against the pain of abuse. Does that strike another note in you? Often only one or two of the subpersonalities would be conscious of the abuse, while the others would have no memory or experience of the pain. To a great extent, the personality of the African-American today has been shaped by our desires to escape the memory of the slave experience, to deny its existence. We don't want to talk about it. We don't want to come in terms with it. We don't want to re-experience it psychologically. We don't want to know about it. And therefore, our lives become defined by eternal escape and avoidance of reality and of history and of a knowledge of who we are and how we came to be who and what we are. And consequently, we cannot act upon the reality of our history, and we guide our behavior and define ourselves in terms of a fantasy as history and a misinterpretation of reality. This is what it is. Yes. How did we get this religion we talked about earlier? I talk about Star Trek, and we talk about the time warp that Star Trek depicts quite frequently, of how people move from one state of consciousness and one world and are suddenly flipped into a new world. They go through a warp, and suddenly, all of a sudden, everything that they used to use to guide themselves no longer counts. The language that they used to speak can no longer be understood in the new world. The values that they used to guide their behavior are no longer workable. In fact, it gets them into trouble. The gods, the culture, the nature of the social relations, and all of the things that they used prior to meeting the warp no longer suffice. Now they must learn new values and new behaviors and new orientations in order to adapt themselves to the new universe that they live in. We are in that kind of position today. Think about the African in the world the African lived in prior to being brought across the oceans. Think about the gods we praised. Think about the organization of our society.
Think about the languages that we spoke, the food that we ate, the dress that we wore, the music, the song, the dance, and all of those things that defined us as African people. And think how horrendous it must have been for us to be thrown into this world where there was a whole new language, a whole new social hierarchy, a whole new set of authorities, people pushing you around who you don't understand, people who are putting strange tools in your hands, people who are trying to get you to relate to them and to relate to each other in a very different kind of way from what you're used to relating to. Think about the stress and the confusion, and think about the abuse. Think about the horror of that situation our parents and great-grandparents were put in. And there was somebody that said then, if you pray to this God, if you talk this way, if you dress this way, if you relate this way, you'll get a greater sense of security. Your anxiety will be reduced. You will feel good, and you'll be able to withstand the pain of your existence. And the God then that I'm going to hand you is one that I have created for you. And a theology that comes with it is one that I have created so that you will continue to serve me as you continue to serve it. And we come to believe in the veracity of that God and that religion. Why? Because we feel so secure when we follow it. And we feel so relieved when we follow it. And yet we wonder why, despite all of our prayers, despite all of our devotion, we still suffer the way we do. I often ask the question, why is it that the people who pray the most have the most of their children in the jails of America today? Who shout and kick over the benches and so forth, are filling up the prisons and have the children killing each other and addicted out here in these streets. There must be a problem here, ladies and gentlemen. We must reorient ourselves to our religion. We must reorient ourselves to our gods, because apparently we don't have the appropriate orientation. Because as that book you read says, you can tell a tree by what? The fruit it bears. And therefore, if it bears bitter fruit, or if it bears no fruit at all, the God you worship says it is but fit to be hewn down and thrown into the flame and consumed. Read your own Bible. It gives you a very practical measure as to whether the religion you're pursuing is an appropriate one. And that measure says, look at the fruit that it bears. And if then the kind of religion and the God you're pursuing ends up having your sons in the jails of America and ends up maintaining African people in slavery and servitude in their own lands and everywhere, then something is wrong in terms of how we relate to that religion and that God, because the outcome is wrong and the outcome is destructive. And it's because we don't want to confront the abuse that we went through and deal with. You see, when you go through that time warp, the only way you can ultimately come to understand the new world is to understand what happened when you went through that warp that transformed what? The personality. That made the personality what it was. And I find that interesting when further over, when I read here of what happens when the personality moves from one personality to another, when the body is possessed by one personality and that personality is displaced and another one comes in. It says, during the switch, there is typically a period of seconds or even minutes when heart rate, breath rate, and other physiological markers show a disorganization that is followed by a new pattern typical of the personality that is emerging. In other words, then, we go through a period of disorganization and stress, and then the personality is reorganized
to fit into the new circumstances. We can't continue to pursue this, but it's interesting to look at the changes in blood pressure that each personality brings about, the other kinds of changes, physical changes that are representative of the personality. So what are we saying here then? That each personality has its own name, its own history, its own memory, biography, way of speaking, language, way of thinking, way of perceiving itself, its own vulnerabilities. Each personality generates its own life space and generates its own types of social relations. Each personality has its own taste and appetite and its own morality. So to a great extent then, if we look at the problems and issues that confront us today as African people and see those issues in terms of the consciousness, we would recognize that we must rid ourselves of the consciousness that has been implanted in us by our European masters. One other thing I want to bring about in this situation, we notice that if you engage people in behavior therapy and you scan their brains and look at how their brains metabolize energy, there's a relationship between the areas of the brain that are rapidly using energy and the type of mental activity a person is undergoing and the type of physical behavioral activity the person is undergoing. Each personality, each type of orientation has a blueprint in the brain in terms of the various areas of the brain that are functionally relating one to the other. And it's interesting to note, for instance, that we look at something called the obsessive-compulsive personality, the person who cannot stop repeating a particular behavior, no matter how irrational it may be, the person who must wash their hands every 30 minutes, even if they are not dirty, but who are compelled to the point that they wash their hands to the point of rawness because they cannot stop, is this kind of person. The person who is absorbed by a particular type of image, by a particular kind of thought or orientation that they cannot get out of their mind. This is what we talk about when we talk about the obsessive-compulsive personality, a rigid, repetitive personality. We note then, if you scan the brains of these personalities, that certain areas in their brain are intensely active. For instance, we talk about their frontal lobes, the so-called orbital lobe of the brain, the orbital cortex of the brain, the part of the cortex that is above the eyes, the part of the cortex that concerns itself with intentionality and purpose and direction and motivation, and the connection of that cortex to the lower brain, to the what we call the caudate nucleus, that part of the lower brain that deals with repetitive behavior, that deals with monitoring, that deals with modulating behavior, that deals with, in its connection with the hypothalamus and with the thalamus, with senses, with the distribution of the senses, and with organizing the senses. When we look then at the compulsive personality, we notice that these areas are intensely active, and active in a way that they maintain the symptoms of that personality. It has been shown then that when these people take a drug such as Prozac, the intensity of the, and they respond to them in a way that their symptoms are relieved, the intensity of the interaction between these three brain areas is decreased or delinked. It has also been noted then that you can put these same types of people through behavior therapy. That is, by changing the nature of the social relationship between the therapist and the patient, changing the nature of the rewards and punishments that the patient undergoes in an effort to change the patient's behavior, by changing the way the patient thinks about what is in their mind, thinks about the problems that they're in. And when you can successfully then reduce the symptoms of the compulsive disorder through this social conditioning, we note too the same kinds of physiological brain changes that occurs with the intake of the drug occurs with the intake of social training. Now, what are we saying then? That the, yes, that too, but what we're saying ultimately then is that the nature of the consciousness and the nature of the experience of the individual physically transforms the brain and physically transforms the way the brain operates. And therefore, when we talk about consciousness, we're talking about something that is real. We're talking about something that transforms both the psyche and the body. One of the things that you note when the individual is possessed, that the facial muscles change and that the body itself changes in a way that it literally incarnates and represents the nature of the spirit that contains, that it, that is possessing the individual. So to a good extent, if you're in certain religions, you can tell what particular spirit is possessing the person by the very nature of the behavior that the individual is exhibiting and the very shape of their very physiological body and their face. In other words, ladies and gentlemen, once we get the spirits of these demons that the Europeans have implanted in our bodies, our faces and our bodies themselves will be transformed. To a great extent then, a lot of the way we look and a lot of the way we have organized ourselves physically is a result of the type of consciousness that we have. To a great extent, and I will begin to wrap it up here, to a great extent, the kind of consciousness that inhabits us reflects the kind of culture that we live in, the nature of the culture that we are a part of. Recognize, ladies and gentlemen, that culture cannot exist outside of our minds and of our bodies. Culture does not exist out there. History does not exist out there. History and culture can only exist in the minds and bodies of people. If there were no people in the world, there would be no history in the world, no culture in the world. Culture does not stand outside and direct us. It is where? Inside of us, and it directs us from the inside. Culture is instilled in our bodies and in our minds. And we have to keep that in mind, because sometimes we tend to see it as something separate from ourselves. Culture indwells in us, and it inhabits our bodies. Our history dwells in us and it inhabits our bodies. We reflect our history and we reproduce our history when that history becomes a part of us and is one with us. We tend to see culture in terms of music, in terms of the kind of dance we have, in terms of the songs we sing. And that is a part of culture. But ultimately, culture is deeper than that. Culture is a way of thinking. Ultimately, culture is a conspiracy. That is, it is a means by which a group of people organize the way they think, organize the way they believe, organize the way they see the world, so as to create a consciousness by which they can cooperate in achieving certain ends, so that they can mutually aid each other and gain ends that they cannot gain as separate individuals. So culture is an instrument of power. The individual through culture extends his power, and the culture extends the power of the group. When we talk about music and song and dance, what we are talking about here then is how culture ultimately comes to be implanted in our bodies. You see, we tend to look at song and dance and music as entertainment. And this is a serious mistake.
We have a lot of our youth out there looking at music as mere entertainment. When we say that we are being enculturated, it means that a spirit is being implanted in us by the culture. It means our group is instilling in our bodies and in our minds a possessing spirit such that when our culture calls our name, we respond to it. When our culture is in need of defense and support, we then defend it and support it because we are at one with it. In other words, why does the black man respond to the white man? Why does the black man serve the white man? Why does everything the black man do benefit the white man? Why does the black man say freedom is doing what I want to do? And why is it that everything he wants to do enriches the European? Why is it that our youth say that they are being free and that they're doing what they want to do and they're expressing themselves and it involves buying a $100 pair of sneakers from white folk? Yes. Yes. All of this kind of stuff. Why? Because the spirit that is implanted in the human mind and in the human psyche is there to only respond to its creator and to its master. And therefore, when you let another people generate a spirit in you, when you let another people generate certain values in you, when you let another people generate a certain look, generate a certain reality for you, when you let another people let you see yourself in a particular sort of way and see your own people in a particular sort of way, they have implanted a spirit, and that spirit has been created by them, and that spirit only responds to them, and it only responds to them in terms of furthering their interest and working against the interest of the body it possesses. And this is why there's that self-destructive spirit in us. Because the demon that possesses a body is not there for that body. It is there for the creator that placed it there. And if necessary to obey its creator, it destroys that body. It will destroy the body it inhabits. The taste that that spirit has will be taste that can only be satisfied by buying from its master creator. The values that that spirit wishes to satisfy and realize can only be realized by going through the aegis of the master that created it. That is why every value and every taste and every desire and every need that provokes us, every one of these things that we seek to desire, ends up having us going through white folk. And that's why we think we need them. And every time we satisfy them, they in some way benefit in our seeking satisfaction. Because of the demon that we call ourselves is answering to the call of its master. So a culture creates its own possessing spirit and enculturates and inculcates those spirits into the bodies of its members so that those members, in defending their own egos, in defending their own interests, in defending what they perceive as their own needs, in satisfying their own taste, in satisfying their own values, satisfy the needs of the culture, enrich the culture, empower the culture, defend the culture, advance the interests of the culture. And how then does the culture implant its spirit into its members? It does it in a very strong and primordial way. It uses vehicles. And one of the major vehicles it's used is music. Rhythm. Song,
dance. A culture involves people moving what? Together, in tandem, in rhythm. It involves them having the same temporal sense, the same kind of time clock, so that they can move in synchrony one with the other. And music is about synchrony. Poetry is about synchrony. Song is about synchrony. Music is about symbols. And you see, ultimately, it is through symbols that you evoke behavior from people. So when a culture creates symbols, those symbols are designed to evoke particular types of reactions and feelings and moods in its members. And a culture establishes the potency of those symbols through ritual, through song, and through dance. And one of the best ways then to inculcate cultural values, a cultural spirit, is through entertainment. It's while the members are being entertained, while they are feeling good, the song is carrying the cultural values into the mind and into the body. The lyrics that represent the cultural interests, the lyrics that represent cultural values, are being carried on the vehicle of the music, carried through the vehicle of the poetry. The togetherness, the cooperativeness, the mutual movement together and the synchrony of the culture is being entrained through the music and through the rhythm of the dance. Therefore, you see, when you let another over your music, when you let another people take over your dance and attach their content to it, they will use your own music and your own dance and your own rap lyrics and your own poetry and your own cultural symbols to carry their message into your body and into your mind, such that you can only respond then to their beck and call and to their wishes.